amazed how many people own stocks.
Welcome to Playing Footsie, the podcast where we talk about stocks, investing, and personal finance. Before we start, we want to make it clear that the information presented on this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. None of us is a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. Investing in the stock market comes with risks, and we strongly encourage our listeners to do their own research and consult with a licensed financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Now, let's dive into the world of finance and talk about what we're doing with our money.
The sucker's going up.
Welcome to the Playing Footsie Show, brought to you in association with Trading 212. My name's Steve W, and this week the stock market's been in a difficult place. Warner Brothers Discovery has hit new lows. FTSE 100 miners have been reporting their earnings, and they've generally not gone terribly well. And cybersecurity stocks have also taken a bit of a dive. But joining me to talk about none of those things, but some more interesting stuff, and stuff that's been very much heading in the right direction, is Steve D. Steve, how are you, and how's your week been?
Pretty busy week, Steve, for me, really. All of our management has been away looking at trees in a different country. So I've been left sort of holding the fort with the two juniors, or one of them's a junior, one of them's only just not become a junior. So I've had a really, really busy week. So I haven't had a chance to look at too much. And I guess that will probably reveal itself when Steve's doing 9/10 of the companies this week. And I've done one. But in stocks, I've had a fairly busy week. I've been sort of toying with trying to do less. And I managed that for all of January. But February has been an unmitigated disaster. I've turned into the Claudio Ranieri of stocks. And I've started tinkering. And I've made a couple of sales. So I wanted to add to my Bloomsbury position. Steve will have woken up on, I think, Tuesday to about 19 messages of me convincing myself to buy Bloomsbury. It was just like a list of basically like a conversation, but only I was having it. And then Steve helped me straighten out some things. And I ended up buying, about 50% more Bloomsbury. So I'm up to about 3.5% in that. And that took my cash balance down a little bit. And then I thought, right, nothing else. Won't mess around. And then Palo Alto happened. And I ran the numbers on that. Obviously, it's a very similar sort of company to Fortinet. I was sort of umming and ahhing on whether I want them both. And then I ended up biting the bullet on that as well. And I made that a 2.5% position, which took me over the amount of stocks that I wanted to have. I had some piddly positions. So I ended up cutting DS Smith. That went out of the portfolio with about, I think it was a 15 or 20% return, which is fine. That was a good return for the amount of time that I'd held it. And then I also cut Tencent as well because I just decided that I don't want to be exposed to the China risk anymore. Disney gives me some exposure to Epic Games, which is something I was quite interested in having exposure to through Tencent. Not the sole reason, but one of the reasons that I was very interested in it. So I thought, right, I can get rid of Tencent. I can cut that bit of risk out of my portfolio where I just, you know, it's a market I don't understand. It's a country I've never been to. It's a country I probably won't ever go to. So, yeah, I cut that out as well. So I ended up buying a little bit more Progeny after that. I've done nothing else since. I've got about 3.5% of my money is in cash still. And still looking for opportunities, Steve. So a busy week than I anticipated. Was yours anything like that?
No. I have been to China, though, and I've seen WeChat in action, one of the Tencent kind of big things, and I speak very positively for it, both in terms of its kind of ubiquitousness, I think, and the kind of general quality of the thing. It's really, really good. That said, I have been going increasingly bearish on China, if that's possible. I've stayed away from the Chinese stuff recently, mostly because of reasons to do with VIE structures and so on and so forth. I'm increasingly going off it from a macroeconomic perspective as well, as I mentioned to you sort of earlier in the week. So I'm becoming less and less convinced that there's actually a great opportunity here, even if you discount the risk of the structure potentially being, not potentially, basically being illegal and the Chinese government potentially caring about it. So I'm happy enough with that move. Bloomsbury looked quite nice to me. We had a bit of a look at some stuff from different places as well on that, where there's some interesting write-ups on the way they're kind of moving forward. But it's a fun kind of small cap area to be in. And it's like, it's a small cap for now, not a large cap that's going to become a small cap, as we were also talking about in the sort of mid to longer term future. I was much less active than you were. I had a sort of weird dividend from trading 212. I got a dividend today that appeared to be paid in about 5 installments, and it's fine. They all came in at about the same time. It didn't make any difference to anything, but I got 5 notifications for the same dividend, just in different sizes, which I think I probably slightly prefer to receive dividends like that. It's not held in a pie or anything like that. It was just sat in my account, but it's nice. It somehow feels like more if you get it in bits like that. Portfolio-wise, it's been an interesting week for me. So my portfolio, when I calculated it, the markets are still technically open, so strictly the indices could be moving, as could mine, but I worked it out before we came on air. I am plus 1.12% for my portfolio, and the FTSE 100 is a rounding error from flat. It's minus 0.07 of a percent. It's actually recovered quite nicely from a decent-sized drop on Wednesday, but it's basically where it started the week. The S&P 500 was, when I looked, plus 1.19%, so I'm a fraction behind that. And the VWRL, the World Index, is plus 1.12%, so I am bang in line with the world, broadly speaking, ahead of the UK and behind the US for this week. And as with every week, I couldn't really care less about the week-to-week moves on this. Your shuffling around makes it a bit harder to work out where you kind of come out on things here, Steve, right?
Yeah, and I haven't really bothered because of that. I was trying to figure it out just before we went on air today, and it just seems that I am roughly flat, looking at the line quite lazily on trading 212. The line has gone up, but as has the amount that I have invested. So I would estimate that roughly I am flat. Just looking at my week's return spreadsheet, again, that's no good either because it's got Palo Alto on there, minus 23.45%, and I think I'm up about 6%. So that's no good to me either. But that's telling me up 14, down 14. So if that was a representative of being largely flat, it probably is. I reckon I am largely flat.
Lazily looking at the line. It's like having Paul back on the show, isn't it? Outside of the markets, my week has been pretty horrible. Wife's been at a funeral for the last couple of days in Scotland, so I've been at home with the now 20-monther. Basically, that's a matter of hanging on until she gets back and there's two of us to deal with things because he doesn't do too well overnight. So since Wednesday afternoon, it's been just me and him, and we've been making our way through just fine. I had this idea of the finish line in mind, which was 8 a.m. this morning when I drop him off at nursery, because after that, she gets back around midday, takes over for the afternoon. So everything was just geared to get to that finish line. And after another horrible night last night, he actually slept in till 7, which was great because it was just a quick get up, whiz into your clothes, brush teeth quickly, outdoor, off to nursery, basically. And we managed that quite nicely, and I was cheerfully on my way to the finish line I've been looking at since the start of the week, to be honest, 8 a.m. at nursery. And we got to 8 a.m. at nursery, and I picked him up to get him out of the car, and he vommed all over me and all over himself and all over the car and all over the car park. So with him screaming and miserable, and he can't go into nursery like that, I put him back in the car and drove him home, and then we looked after him for till lunchtime. He's a bit under the weather. He's got a bit of a bug, I think. It's nothing particularly major, but suddenly the finish line that I'd had my eye on for so long zoomed off into the distance, covered in rotten milk, basically, which was, yeah, tough one for the week. But the portfolio at least has managed to inch forward, even if I have not. I've consumed something, though, Steve, and this is a fun one that I've been consuming. Last time I talked about the Prof G Markets show on this show, I was complaining about it. And I'm sort of complaining about it again for a different reason. This is a thinly disguised rant, and I'm never quite sure what our viewership thinks of this. But here's what I was listening to. It's not the most recent episode of Prof G Markets. It's the review of Q4 with Aswath Damodaran. So Q4 results are still coming in. We'll talk about some of those in a little bit. But from about 2 weeks ago, Damodaran, known as the Dean of Valuation being his thing, he thinks very carefully about how to value businesses, and is a frequent guest on CNBC, appeared on the Prof G Markets show to talk about Q4, not just valuations, but general thoughts on the market. Lots of it was very, very interesting from Damodaran, and he's someone that I think everybody rates highly. The people who don't rate him highly only think that because he disagrees with them and they're scared of him. Because he's cleverer than they are, so they're not quite sure what to make of him, so they just get cross. Fair enough. But I think there's no one who doesn't think, at least deep down, that he's very, very thoughtful, very, very intelligent. And if you disagree with his views, that's one thing, but he will have a pretty well thought out reason for holding the views that he holds. Anyway, a couple of things that he said stood out to me. One of them was his interesting views on the Magnificent Seven. Quick guessing game for you, Steve, since I'll assume you have not consumed this. His view on the Magnificent Seven, as this is as of 2 weeks ago, by the way, so pre the most recent set of earnings for some of them, but post for most of them. The Magnificent Seven, he said pretty much all of them were fully valued, at the moment. Two of them, he said, were significantly overvalued. Can you guess which two they were? Because I would have got one out of the two and not the other one.
So, I was going to sort of set myself up for getting this wrong by saying I think I may know the answer to this. But I wonder if it's Netflix and Apple would be my guess for the two.
Interesting. You would have got neither of them in that case. So he thinks Netflix and Apple are both fully valued but not massively overvalued. The two he thinks are significantly over is Microsoft for one of them and Nvidia for the other. I would have got Microsoft. For some reason, I would not have got Nvidia. I thought it was going to be Tesla and Microsoft, but I'm wrong about that as well. It's basically the two AI things. He sees quite a large AI unproven hype train driving through this at the moment, and the two that are closest to it. So Microsoft arguably closer than Alphabet to it at the moment, though the two, and Alphabet isn't far away, nor is Meta far away. Apple arguably isn't either, but the real kind of AI productive stuff is coming out of Microsoft and Nvidia. And as a result, those are, he thinks, quite extended at the moment, the others being, close, but he views these as kind of aging businesses. He's got the whole life cycle of businesses and likes it very much when businesses that are old behave like they're old rather than trying to behave like they're in hypergrowth mode still. Anyway, that's the interesting bit. Here's the bit that I find, let's say, somewhere between bewildering and annoying, like a lot of things on this show. Scott Galloway is sort of fairly routinely says that valuation is subjective. And he says this, generally speaking, when he doesn't want to try and tell you a valuation for something or he wants to ignore the price of something. Either he doesn't know what that means, or De Modron has no business being on his show, as far as I can tell. So to say that valuation is subjective, just for anyone who's not clear, this is a kind of term that comes up a lot in various areas of philosophy, is to say that any statement of the form X is worth Y, or the value of X is Y, is strictly shorthand for X is worth Y according to this person, or according to that person, or according to some different person, to me, or to you, or whoever. There is no such thing as what something is worth independent of people. There is no further standard also for comparing different people's views on these things. If I think evaluation is really subjective and I think Nvidia is worth this and Steve thinks Nvidia is worth that and we have different ideas, neither of us can be closer to the truth because there is no further truth. All there is what it's worth according to someone. A good example of something that people think is subjective more commonly is beauty. So there's a lot of people think, look, there just is no fact about whether Shakespeare's plays are better than Picasso's paintings and so on. If Steve thinks one thing and I think another thing, we might change our minds, but we wouldn't get closer to the truth or any further from the truth just because there isn't a truth. There's just what he thinks and what I think. And look, if you have that view about valuation for the moment, leave aside whether you have it about beauty for the time being, why someone is on your show whose thing is saying here are valuations, here's why you should believe me, is insane, basically, because there is no reason to believe what this person thinks rather than what you think. It's just what something is worth according to you, what something is worth according to him. If you change your mind and join his side, you won't be any closer to the true value of something because there isn't a true value. There's only the value according to the Modern, the value according to me, the value according to Steve. If Steve thinks Tesla is worth $2 and I think it's worth $2,000, neither of us is right, full stop. Neither of us is wrong, full stop. He's right according to him and I'm right according to me. And that's it. Now, I don't think valuation is subjective, by the way. I think there are objective facts about valuations. I think it's possible to be wrong. And that's why I think there's value in having Damodaran on a show. And presumably he also thinks that what he does is attempt to get at the objective, truthful, accurate value of stuff rather than just express his views. But for someone like Scott Galloway, who thinks that valuation is subjective, the idea you would then bring a valuation expert on and nod and be like, yes, this is important when they say things, is just a mind-boggling thing to me with my philosopher hat on. Anyway, that's the thing that I consumed this week, Steve. You a fan of either Damodaran or Galloway, or both, or neither?
So I can like Galloway occasionally on some subjects, particularly marketing and things like that. He's usually pretty sharp on things like that. He's normally got a take that I quite enjoy. But I think at the moment he's sort of stuck talking his books a little bit, and his books aren't very good. And I mean, I tried to read post-corona to try and help me understand a little bit more about him, but he is a not very interesting writer. Definitely doesn't live up to the sort of big dog character that he claims to be on the podcast. His writing is really, really dull in comparison. So no, I mean, Damodaran, I'm a massive fan. I do regularly listen to his lectures. I actually managed to listen to the opening class lecture. Is he at Stern? He is at Stern, isn't he? NYU Stern. Yeah, I listened to the opening class lecture for corporate finance the other day, just because it was quite interesting to see that. He puts them all up on YouTube for them to listen to, and I thought, well, why not? Why can't I do it? Yeah, really interesting to see how he works and how he talks, and really the amount of time he's prepared to gift to the students there. But Steve, I have a consumption. Off air I said I didn't have a consumption, but I do actually have one quickly, and it does come in the form of a short quiz in the same way that yours did. But somebody was whinging the other day in the Trading 212 forum that, oh, the Magnificent Seven are the only ones delivering returns. So I said, well, that's not what I'm seeing. In fact, in January and February of this year, the bull market has been quite broad. So I'll give you, Steve, the first 10 companies in the S&P 500 by year-to-date return. So forget about weightings, just thinking about year-to-date return, Steve. Who do you think's at the top?
Eli Lilly.
So Eli Lilly is actually third.
That's not bad then.
Top.
Is it Nvidia?
It is Nvidia, yes, at 58.59%. Yeah. Do you want to have a guess, Steve, at any of the other companies? I'll give you the top 20.
Oh, okay. Meta.
So Meta is second. One more.
Mm-hmm. What else has done well this year? S&P 500. What else has gone off the chain? Is it Microsoft?
Microsoft are not in the top 20. So I'll just give you a quick rundown of these, Steve. Are you ready?
Yeah.
So it's Nvidia at the top, and then it goes Meta, Eli Lilly, Catalan, Tapestry Inc., Ralph Lauren, Uber Technologies, Juniper Networks, Advanced Micro Devices, AMD, Viatris, Applied Materials, WR Berkeley Corp., Netflix, Lam Research, Progressive, that's an insurer, Howmet Aerospace Inc., Walter Disney, General Electric Company, Merck, and Southwest Airlines. After that, Steve, you don't get any better because you're getting Brown & Brown and Eaton Corp in 21 and 22. So if that isn't, that's a fairly broad range of industries there to be in the top 20. And now I appreciate now when you add weighting onto that, it changes everything about it because the Magnificent Seven are so big. They dwarf what something like Catalan, which is up 30% this year, would affect, our Tapestry, which I think is even smaller than Catalan. But weighting doesn't really matter when you're in individual stocks because you'll get the full benefit of your 30% return if you had Catalan. If you had the same amount of Catalan as you did Microsoft, you would have got a better return out of Catalan this year. Just interesting. Now I'll post that chart up for anybody who wants to have a look at it as my little bit of consumption. But I thought that was pretty interesting, Steve. This bull market is and has felt to me to be a little bit broader than people are letting on.
Yeah, agree. When you said it was a point about a broad bull market, I immediately thought Eli Lilly's going to be in there somewhere. I'm now annoyed that I looked myself off of Nvidia. But actually outside that top three, It's companies that I am aware were up because I've seen notifications saying they were up or news items saying they were up, but actually it would have been a while until I'd guessed my way towards them. Like, I knew Applied Materials had done well recently, and I knew about Netflix as well, but they weren't, they probably wouldn't have been in my next four or five guesses, to be honest. I was groping quite badly there, but yeah, that's really interesting. I'm interested what, in there is a decent range of industries there, isn't there?
There is. What do you think's done better, Steve? Berkshire Hathaway or Amazon?
Berkshire,
yeah. Berkshire's 32nd on the list. Amazon is a lot further down. I think it's in the 40s
somewhere.
47.
Berkshire's at or near or very near all-time highs. I note this because the thing keeps telling me nearly every day. Waste management, that's at all-time highs as well, but I don't think it's done that much this year.
35th. It's quite a bit higher.
That's respectable for a bin emptying company, basically. Anyway, yeah. Should we talk about some not US things, Steve?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's talk about Lloyds then. So the largest UK retail bank by largest UK bank by retail share of deposits, the lowest share price in the FTSE 100, which means there's often some interest in it from people who don't like fractional shares. But they reported earnings this week, and we haven't talked about them very much on this show, so it's time to have a chat about them. The stock is up 5% on the week, has a market cap of $29 billion at the moment. And in line with a sort of general trend in the banking sector, these are the reports for the full year of 2023. So some of them you would already know if you were following the stock during 20, or you have the general shape of it from 2023. But this kind of plugs in the last piece, basically. And what we saw was, in line with other stuff, but generally quite a strong 2023 from Lloyds, but tapering towards the end for the last 3 months. So Q4 started to come down a little bit lower. So the full year results came in like this. Pre-tax profits were $7.5 billion on a market cap of 29. That's 57% higher than the year before in 2022, and it's the highest they've been for 20 years. That's not a massive surprise, because interest rates are somewhere near the highest they've been for about 20 years. I think 2008 they may have been slightly higher, but we're closing in on, we're coming off a period of very, very low interest rates, so you'd expect Lloyd's profitability to kick up. And then there's net interest margins, which are an important banking metric, which is roughly speaking the spread or margin spread between the amount you pay out in interest on deposits and the amount you take in interest on loans. And the margin on that was 3.11%. That doesn't sound like a huge number, and it's not a huge number, but the previous year it was up from 2.94, so it crosses the 3% mark. And actually, when you're looking at the sort of volumes of assets and liabilities, so deposits and loans that Lloyds has, it's the biggest of them here. A couple of basis points here is sticking millions on, basically, in this kind of cases. So that was the year in Q3, and if you thought that was going to go on forever, you would buy this stock tomorrow, basically. If you thought $7.5 billion in pre-tax profits is coming in, you would buy it at 29 and say, thanks very much, I'll just keep taking that year after year. But there's reason for thinking that things are going the other way. There's a few reasons, actually, but one of them is the Q4 results. So Q4 wasn't so strong. It was... I mentioned before they were at a 3.11 for the year net interest margin. That went down to 2.98 in Q4. It actually went down from 3.08, so slightly below the average. It's been coming down during the year to 2.98. Things are starting to come in a little bit, partly as people expect interest rates to come down and partly as competition enters the market here and mortgage rates especially start to get. You've seen them sort of flattening off a little bit, actually, so that wouldn't surprise you to know that margins came in a little bit. Pre-tax profits were at $1.78 billion rather than $1.86 billion, which is where Q3 was. Over and above the kind of lending business, which is mostly what Lloyds is, there were a couple of kind of additional items, and the additional items giveth and the additional items taketh away again. So they had a $540 million increase or boost, basically, because they made a loan to the Daily Telegraph's company, which they thought had gone dead a long time ago and pretty much impaired it, but they actually got paid for that, so they got $541 million back again that they weren't expecting, which is a nice surprise, I guess. It's sort of like getting a dividend off a company that you've forgotten you've sold or something, but a $540 million one. So that's nice. On the other hand, they're being investigated, as are a lot of lenders, by the way. This is not a Lloyd-specific thing, for practices around sales of motor insurance. and they've set aside $450 million for reserves to cover the potential fines coming out of that. They're not the only people on the hook for this by a long way. It's hard, as far as I can see, to tell who the main kind of affected parties might be. But, so your $540 million, most but not all of that went on a kind of reserve for covering a fine. So, yeah, well, easy come, easy go, I guess. It's around this time of year, I say around this time of year, it's at the end of the financial year, they start announcing plans for things like shareholder returns. And if you've had a big year for profits, you might well think that you get a big year for shareholder returns as well. And you would not be wrong in this situation. They're planning on buying back another $2 billion in stock. That's the same as in 2022, from the year before. A $2 billion buyback on a $29 billion and market cap is significant enough to be worth looking at. And they're paying out 2.76p per share in dividends for the final one, which will take you to, for a total, which is a 15% increase on the 2.4p that you got before. So actually, they've returned about 12% or so of their market cap to shareholders this year, one way or another. The issue is that things look like they're arcing downwards a little bit. What I would say about Lloyds is that they're traditionally what's thought to be their big advantage is their large base of retail deposits. Even in a world where switching costs for banks, let's say at least, ain't what they used to be, and Steve is probably one of the most enthusiastic people at switching banks I've ever met, I think, when it suits him, and that's fine, that's within the rules. Lloyds is either not seeing people switching away or seeing as many people switching in as switching away. So their customer deposit base was very, very slightly up, basically flat. But it tells you they're holding on as much as anything to this kind of large basis of stuff that they have as their big competitive advantage thing. The stock still looks kind of cheap, so it went up 5%. It depends a little bit on what you think the outlook looks like here. I mean, at today's prices, this is a stock that looks very cheap. It feels like it's coming through a cyclical high, and the cyclical lows are not as good as the cyclical highs. But the real question is, I guess, whether it's cheap enough to buy at these levels. Steve, I think you at some point have owned at least one UK bank, but I don't think... Well, actually, I know you've owned Lloyds, because I have, because it's 50p, and, well, less than 50p now. It's banging around 45. What are your thoughts about this company?
So Lloyds is pretty much renowned for having its really, really strong mortgage book. So I was just flicking through the report now, just looking at that mortgage bucket, and actually it looks pretty fine. They've exited a little bit here, but largely this is a very strong looking, quite large mortgage book. So you would assume that more and more mortgages rolling off at these kind of while the rates are a little bit higher is only going to serve them well, providing people can keep up with it. And looking at the impairments on this quarter, there's actually quite a lot less than I was expecting. I would have thought that impairments would have gone up quite a bit as people rolled off those lower charges and onto these higher ones. But I guess this is not going to be a shock to people. They've probably been able to see this coming for, you know, maybe a year, maybe 18 months now. So hopefully people have been able to prepare in such a way to avoid this. So, I mean, we're looking at like a almost fivefold reduction in impairment as well, which is... It's very sizable, considering the size of the size of this book. But this is quite an interesting looking stock to me, Steve. Again, it's not a stock that I particularly want to own. I'm seeing decreases of 1% on the customer deposits, which is largely flat. That really depends on what time of the month you record that close. I would assume at 1% there. An interesting looking company. One of the good things you've got with something like Lloyds is they're really focused on operating costs at the moment. So even though they have gone up a little bit, the reduction of all of the physical branches reduction of some physical branches will really help help drive some profit down to the bottom line. And at the moment they're really, really heavily into capital return. So if you want a stock that potentially will stay roughly where it is, but you'll get an increase in dividend that they're committed to, plus an increase in dividend because they're going to buy back stock at a fair amount, then this is the kind of company you're into. So looks like they're trying to from here, it looks like they're trying to get into other markets. They're trying to grow unsecured retail and motor finance. 12% growth in assets under administration with the insurance, pensions and investment section. About 5.1 billion of net new money in as well. So that's a nice little flywheel to come along that might just become something interesting to shareholders. But largely, this is a what you would expect kind of bank report for something at this kind of state in the cycle. It looks fine. There's nothing to worry about. It's not a particularly expensive stock, Steve. But there's also that thing that people say when they look at banks, where they say, if this was trading at a 15 PE, it would be X. And I think that's quite unrealistic. I think where these banks are trading is only a couple of bits, a couple of PE, say, above where, you know, where max is for something like this. I think people just don't trust the banks anymore. Investors don't want to keep their money in these kind of companies, even though that these banks have long since split off the risky parts of themselves with the not so risky parts of themselves. Or traditional banking and investment banking products are so split from each other now that there's no chance, or very little chance, of anything going significantly wrong, or anything unforeseen going significantly wrong here. But yeah, I think this is a bank doing banky things, Steve.
It is a bank doing banky things, and actually there is something good to be said for that by itself, in that it's not a bank doing ridiculous things or a bank running into trouble quite a lot. Its share price isn't actually that far from where it was around last year's crisis, when everyone was panicking about SVB, partly because its share price takes an act of God to move it, and it didn't actually go down that much, but it's still kicking around kind of crisis levels here. I, like you, was kind of pleasantly surprised a bit at the, and this is across the board actually, not just Lloyds, but including Lloyds, the fact that loan defaults weren't higher, people getting into trouble with their mortgages. The Bank of England has been holding interest rates steady for quite a while now, trying to sort of finish inflation off a little bit, or at least finish off this round of inflation. And I've seen in the news this week a couple of people from various organisations piping up and saying, oh, it's getting dangerous leaving it at this level for much longer. The bank needs to cut soon. The bank needs to bring down rates. Recession coming, trouble coming, household budgets coming under trouble. I'm not sure whether I buy that or not, but I think this speaks, in fairness, to the credit of the Bank of England, that at these rates, people are not just defaulting right, left and centre on their mortgages, or at least they're not on the Lloyds mortgage book or any of the other bigs, in fairness. So if you think one of the risks of this is, you know, huge rates of loan defaults all over the place as things become unaffordable, so far, not really. I mean, in general, I would have thought, or I was expecting to see higher interest rates mean higher margins and higher defaults, and I would expect the net balance of that to be better for banks rather than lower margins and lower defaults. A kind of, well, we'll live with some of the idea that some of the loans are going to go bad because we'll make so much money on the other ones that will in general be better off. And that's pretty much what you've seen here. Lloyds is, I think, the bank that I looked at this week that it's hardest to have the strongest feeling over. That doesn't make it a bad thing, though, from what I can tell. I mean, I think it's, you're absolutely right in that if you think about PE ratios and you think this is a PE ratio based on some earnings that are, I mean, it looks like they're close to a cyclical high, even if they're not at it, they may well be at it. So this is a PE ratio based on pretty ambitious E earnings. It's still not terribly high. It still looks kind of reasonable here. It depends on how far you think they're going to come down. There is clear room for them to come down is the thought here. And if they come down a bit, then you've still got something that looks like good value. If they fall off a cliff, then you haven't got something that looks like good value. And that's the thing to kind of weigh up here. Lloyds, until before this set of earnings, so until about last week or so, would have been my pick of the UK banks. I'm now not sure. It's kind of close between that one and another one. So shall we shuffle onwards?
Just before we do, So when you're looking at banks, there's a few key metrics, and Steve's listed quite a few off there, but I'll just add a few extra that it's worth looking at and considering. So I'll leave these as homework. I won't try and over-explain them. But there's net interest margin is something that you should look at, and you would want that net interest margin to be trending with the base rate, essentially. So if the base rate is going up, you would want this net interest margin to be to be trailing it. You maybe around half it. You don't usually get all the way towards it, but that's something to watch. Asset quality ratio is something that you want to look at. You probably want to be looking for something that's about 30 basis points, and that is the basically the assets versus the impairment assets versus impairments. So that's really saying you want it to be very low, essentially. Return on tangible equity, you want that to be sort of above about 12.5%, I would say, Steve. I don't know if you have a view on that or not. And capital generation, which is the internal capital generation, is basically the money that the bank is producing internally to basically help support its loan book. And that's usually about 1.5%, somewhere along those kind of lines. Steve, is there any other metrics that people tend to look at for banks that I've missed there?
I think that's the main part of it. Return on tangible equity is typically what banks measure themselves to. So they will say, we are looking for this kind of a return on tangible equity. And that will imply a certain level of earnings, depending on what their equity base is, which is partly to say depends on what their assets and liabilities look like. And that can be hard to forecast. So they will typically say, we're looking for this kind of return on tangible equity. I think your number's a good one. I think I'd be prepared to make exceptions for if you got something that's trading at a pretty low price to book. So it depends on exactly what you're paying for that equity. And it might be the case that... So JP Morgan's a good example of a bank, not the same kind of bank as Lloyds, but JP Morgan's a good example of a bank that produces pretty strong returns on tangible equity. You also... It generally doesn't trade below its book value, though, or it only does in a... when everything's looking pretty grim. Compare that with Lloyds as a good example, produces weaker returns on tangible equity, but trades at about 0.7 of its book value, so you get a decent discount like that. I agree that in general, higher is better, and there's a sense in which quality businesses, it's not quite the same as dividing one by the other and saying, here's my number. You get a kind of quality boost by dividing a bigger number by a bigger number that's worth keeping in mind. But yeah, so perhaps a little bit more around returns on tangible equity, but that's the number that banks will generally measure themselves to. Yeah, certainly.
Fair enough. Let's move on.
So Barclays also reported their earnings this week, and the market has taken their earnings quite nicely. The stock is up 11.5% this week. It has a market cap of $25 billion now as a result of all that movement. So what's been going on there? Well, broadly similar things to the larger banking sector, plus a whole load of stuff that's specific to them. So we'll start with a kind of ordinary banking operations-y business first then. Net interest margins for Barclays, the gap between interest on loans and interest on deposits, came in pretty well, actually. They managed a net interest margin of 3.98% for the year in 2023. That's significantly higher than the Lloyds 3.11%, which is pretty good. That's higher than it was in 2022, so that was up from 2.86%. A significant jump for them there. As with nearly every bank in the UK, that fell away in Q4 a little bit, 3.83%, but still higher than the Lloyds 2.98% that they were managing there. And actually, those are two quite small numbers, 3.83 and 2.98, but it's actually a decent jump in between those two. One is quite a lot higher than the other by percentage terms, which I thought was quite notable and quite impressive. Barclays is a different type of operation to Lloyds, but... I think when you match their lending things, that actually speaks quite well to Barclays. So profits in Q4 were not a thing. They recorded a loss of 111 million. And the main reason for that was because they took a 900 million non-cash charge. So in what was otherwise a good year and a strong year for banks, we should probably examine what the hell this 900 million charge thingy is that says we're not making a profit. Non-cash, so worth keeping that in mind, but also not non-existent. The reason is it's a restructuring charge, and Barclays is reshuffling itself. They're going to organise themselves into five divisions. Just as a quick primer here for the moment, Barclays is the only one of the big UK banks that combines a sizable investment banking arm with your kind of ordinary-ish retail consumer banking. And that can be a good thing and it can be a bad thing. It can be, on the one hand, it means that there should be some part of its business that's doing well regardless of what interest rates are doing, because if they're going down, then investment banking gets a boost, and if they're going up, then retail banking gets a boost. I mean, it also means that there's a part of its business that's not doing very well regardless of what operations are doing. And the general objection to Barclays over the last few months and years has been that you get the worst of both worlds and not the best of them, basically. So people kind of concern themselves with the thought of, well, there's always some sort of drag in that case. And exactly how, whether you manage to get the best of both worlds or the worst of both worlds is still sort of there to be discussed a bit. But they're attempting to restructure into five divisions and have them report separately, which will give investors at least much better visibility over what's going on here. And those five divisions are reasonably easy to define, I think, which is, so they're UK consumer, fine, US consumer, fine, UK corporate banking, fine, investment banking, yep, wealth management, cool. Not many there that you would struggle to work out what they do, maybe in the kind of details and stuff, they've also acquired, by the way, Tesco, or found a deal for Tesco's credit card business. They're already the largest credit card provider in the UK, I think, and this adding this on as well makes them, well, I think it now makes them my credit card provider, since I run around with a Tesco club card and put things on that. But the big get bigger in that case, and if you like the look of the UK credit card market, Barclays is a strong place to be here. But anyway, restructuring. They managed a loss of 111 million. They took a fight due to a 900 million non-cash restructure. Setting themselves up into this shape, they reckon, is going to save them 2 billion before 2026. So sending out 900 in non-cash stuff to save 2 billion over the next 3 years or so is impressive. In general, though, cost reductions mean one thing, and that's especially true in the banking sector. It means people will be getting fired. They're looking to bring their workforce down by about 20%, and when you read numbers like that, you think that's quite a lot of money saved, but if we were really employing 20% more people than we needed, or we can afford to lose 20% of this workforce, you do kind of wonder what they were all doing to this point. Admittedly, there are people who think this might be optimistic, by the way, these kind of cost savings. They think or they might be risky, these kind of cost savings. So if you underinvest in your investment banking arm, that needs fairly heavy tech investment to keep itself going, and if you sell yourself short there's plenty of competition that can kick you quite hard and you fall behind. However, the reason this stock is up, I think, is because partly that's an interesting restructuring, and it's good for a company like Barclays that has an arguably unwieldy and difficult to work business model, arguably, to get itself some bit more visibility and help manage things like that. Shareholder returns also look fairly hefty. The kind of headline that featured in all the articles was 10 billion in shareholder returns. That's by 2026. So it's 3 and a bit billion a year. There were 3 billion in returns for 2023. On a market cap of 25 billion now, that's still a significant lump over the next 3 years. Their plan is to hold the dividend flat and do the rest via buybacks. The dividend yield is currently 4.88%. So flat that for 3 years is still something if you're a dividend investor and you're looking for that kind of passive income thing. But meanwhile, just knocking out lumps of the share count with what will be a fairly large set of buybacks for the next 3 years. I think this is a really interesting place to be, Steve. I'm not sure whether Citigroup has exhausted my appetite for bank turnarounds, and I say that mostly from a sort of portfolio perspective, not from a sort of temperament perspective. Turnaround is going quite nicely at Citi, actually, from what I can see or from what my portfolio implies. The trouble is, I'm not sure I want a portfolio just full of bank turnaround stories, even good ones necessarily, which is sort of irrational, but if I felt differently, I think there's lots of interesting going on here that is distinctively Barclays-like. There are the same things to consider, like where will interest rates go, what will loan defaults look like, what kind of appetite will there be for borrowing, and so on and so forth, and what kind of margins will they achieve on this. That said, there's plenty to be interested in here about Barclays that isn't just general banking environment outlook. You once had a dalliance with Barclays, I think. Is this a direction you like them going in?
Yeah, this restructuring looks really good. Just having a look through here, and this actually looks like the sort of business they should have been before, before they announced the restructuring. So that's always a good sign when you look down here and think, well, this makes a lot of sense. But yeah, Steve, I got really held up when you were talking there on that shareholder distribution. It's absolutely incredible. There's basically, you're going to try and buy back essentially a third of the company over the next few years. And also pay you a dividend on top of that as well. So the capital return here is really going to come from inside the company. Any other sort of buying on the side of it is just going to be going to be great. But I'm just going down this list of this presentation as well, and a lot of the stats here jumping out has been very, very similar to Lloyd's. They've done quite well with their loan loss rates, and their credit impairment looks pretty good as well. This acquisition of Tesco's looks okay. It's quite a price to pay for the amount that they're getting, but they're getting about 4.1 billion in consumer loans, 4.2 billion in credit cards, and about 6.7 billion in deposits. So that shouldn't be that too bad to them. It's going to affect their CET1 ratio, but this is a big bank that can afford to swallow up something like this. Shocking that Tesco has about 2,800 employees at their retail bank arm, so I would assume that they're almost all going to get cut. But yeah, this is an interesting looking report from Barclays. Really, it's fairly strong. You sort of pointed out that the share price had jumped up, so I had a quick look, Steve. This is about the price I sold it at. I think I sold it at 158. So and I think that was over a year ago, maybe even a bit longer. So yeah, I wouldn't have I would have collected a dividend over that period of time and a tiny bit of appreciation. But I think I moved into bigger and better things at the time. But yeah, like you, Steve, I'm quite interested in this as well. I think it looks quite yeah, it looks quite interesting to me. Is this something you're planning on picking up?
Tough to say. I mean, I wrote about it this week for Motley Fool, and I pointed out that an 11.5% jump in a week is quite a lot for a stock that is basically flat on 5 years, if you zoom the chart back out again. So this is a significant shift here, and you may well have done better elsewhere, certainly over the long term. The Tesco acquisition, I'm not surprised, and I did wonder at the time, because I was following the story of it developing along, and more banks appeared to be interested in this, and in fact quite deep-pocketed banks, including Lloyd's. And generally when there's a battle on for this bunch of assets, that indicates to me that no one's getting it. Whoever wins, it's not getting it cheap in this case, because Tesco will not care who takes this off their hands. It's effectively their way of admitting defeat in the banking division or credit card market or whichever, and it seems like they're good assets to have, but you can pay too much for good assets. And I got the impression with the amount of competition there was for it that they were going to achieve at least a decent price and probably a better one. I'm going to think about picking this one up. My current instinct is no. But my instinct is not great on this, because at the moment things look great. And not just great, cyclically great, right? There's kind of a sign of decent encouragement for stuff that might be more durable going forward. It's always interesting. So you see the banks kind of doing well over the course of a year, and they pile up big profits in the case of Lloyd's and Barclays. And then the real question is, well, what are you going to do with it? And the answer for Barclays is fire quite a big buyback cannon and shareholder returns thing, and save a whole load of money. I mean, if they can find a way to pull back in the kind of costs that they've incurred in this 900 million, that'll be a really good move. In fact, if they get anywhere near pulling in the kind of costs that they're imagining here, they're looking to save, what did I say, a couple of billion over 3 years, and sending out just under one to do it. I mean, if they pull in 1.5, that'd be a decent return here. Stock is up, but it still doesn't look like it's hugely overvalued to me here. It looks sort of reasonable and interesting, and I wonder whether there's scope to just diversify my bank holdings a little bit here. Diversifying bank holdings, what an expression.
Yeah, it's a strange one. Just looking at this strategy up there from May 2014. So back then they had 139,500 employees. They were in over 50 countries. They had about 436 billion in risk-weighted assets, and the CET1 ratio, which is their liquidity ratio, was only 9.3%. So you'd have been a little bit worried about that then, Steve, a business of that kind of size. And then from that period, that was 10 years ago, they've exited Africa, the commodities market, European retail banking, reduced footprint in Asia, USA and Asia wealth divisions. They have sold German consumer finance business, disposed of the Italian retail mortgages book, which was probably a very good move. And then they've had 16 billion in litigation and conduct issues addressed. That is customer redress, market manipulation and general governance. So now we sit with 92,500 colleagues in only 38 countries with 343 billion in risk-weighted assets, but a CET1 ratio of 13.8%. Now, there's two ways of looking at this, in that essentially you've lost quite a fair chunk of assets there. Maybe a third of assets has disappeared. But also, you've got a lot leaner business here, which is a lot more liquid. So I would say that I would look at it in the second way, that you've got a leaner business that wants to get even leaner, that is operating where it's, you know, in its specialties, and trimmed its assets down to the point where it, you know, it's got assets that it's only comfortable managing whilst keeping itself incredibly liquid. So yeah, I think there's a lot of positives in this report. But yeah, I just thought that was an interesting comparison between then and now. And to say that they're looking to reduce that by another sort of 20%, you know, you'll be looking at another 18 and a bit K off that number, mm-hmm. that 92,500, and that will really help bring down costs. So if they can do the next 10 years, Steve, with bringing down that 20% headcount, but also not having to address $16 billion in litigation and poor conduct related charges, then the next 10 years could be, you know, bearing a massive financial crisis of some description, could look a lot better than perhaps the last 10, where they've made arguably a lot of improvement.
Yeah, 18,000 was about the number I read quoted, actually. I tried to convert that based on the headcount and came out with about 20%. So that's kind of in line with what I'm thinking. And there's lots that's sort of interesting going on there. I'm conscious with time running on a little bit. We've got another bank to talk about, Steve. You've got time for one more, do you think? It's also an interesting one.
Let's do it.
Get ready, Steve, for the opportunity of a lifetime, because here comes NatWest. And I'll tell you what I mean by opportunity of a lifetime in a minute. Let's start with the share price again. So that's gone up. They actually reported at the end of last week rather than this week. So if you hit their 5-day share price chart, it hasn't gone anywhere of much. But the thing is up 8% since its earnings release. And that's not bad for a company like this. Market cap is now $20 billion. And the reason I keep mentioning this is because it matters for things like buybacks and so on, to give you a feel for what they're taking out of their market cap, or at least in theory anyway. So over the year they managed net interest margins of just over 3%, which is a bit lower than Lloyd's at 3.11 and quite significantly lower than Barclays at 3.98, so the weakest in terms of lending margins of the three that we've been talking about. Their Q4 margins, like the other banks, came in lower than their margins earlier in the year. They came down from 2.94 in Q3 to 2.86 in Q4. Again, for comparison, that's 2.98 at Lloyd's, so a bit higher, and 3.83 at Barclays. So you can view that one of two ways. You can view that quite positively for Barclays, or you can view it quite negatively for NatWest. Nonetheless, there are some shareholder returns coming your way if you're a NatWest shareholder. There's an 11.5p dividend yield. There's an 11.5p dividend on the way, which is the final one for 2023. That's about 5% of the current share price that you'll get if you attempt to dividend surf this thing, which I'd recommend that you don't. There's also about $300 million in buybacks, which will get you another 1.5%. So in fairly short order, you can see your way to 6.5% return from shareholder returns here. Fair enough. The company, though, is looking to has some distinctive things to itself. The stuff about kind of buybacks and dividends, and they all matter in these cases, and there's slight variations in there, but that's a fairly common theme that you saw through all of the big banks in the UK. Net interest margins were fairly strong but weakening, and there's decent cash generated that's going to get sent back to shareholders. NatWest has spent most of 2023 dealing with scandals, mostly to do with Nigel Farage, and they've had a change of CEO as a result. Alison Rose goes out, and in comes Paul Thwaite, I think his name is. Came in as the interim CEO, confirmed at the update as the permanent CEO. Good. But that's only the kind of front end of this, so hopefully better things in the future in terms of governance. But the big news for NatWest is that they are currently, I think, about 35% owned by the UK government post-2008 crisis. They still haven't got rid of that stake yet, but they're going to, apparently. Jeremy Hunt is planning on selling this in June, so they're going to take it, unironically, from being public-owned to being private-owned by selling it to members of the public. So try and figure that one out. I'm fascinated by this because I think there's so much noise around this that it's almost impossible to figure anything out, but allow me to have a bash. Jeremy Hunt insists and says that it will be necessary for the government to only sell if they can achieve what he calls full value for the shares. I don't know what full value means, but it does sound like the kind of thing he has to say, because you can't, as a politician, say we're going to dump this at a massive discount. That's not in the national interest particularly. However, I think he's going to have to take some sort of discount to full value, because the big question on my mind is, if you sell them at full value, why is anyone going to buy them? The issue with NatWest is that it seems to be underperforming Lloyds and Barclays at the moment, and as a result, I don't think I want to buy this stock unless someone's offering it to me at a decent discount, in which case I might get interested, to be honest, but then I'd only really be interested because I thought I got it cheap, and then I could try and sell it at market value or something in a kind of arbitrage trading-y type of way here. So look, I get that you can't, if you're the Chancellor, say we're gonna have to fire sell this thing, or we really want to fire sell this thing, but equally, I'm not sure I'm particularly buying this claim that the government's going to achieve full value for it, because I don't see why it should, or why it would be able to. The bigger concern I have with NatWest, though, at the moment, is that what we've just seen in 2023 for pretty much any set of banks was boom time. It's been the uplift in the cycle. Banks do well in those situations, and it's easy to say that they're getting blown along by a nice cyclical tailwind, and that's probably true. But it is probably also worth noting, in fairness, that they are allowed to make money like that. You are allowed to do well in cyclical times if you are a cyclical company. That doesn't mean your profits aren't real or don't exist or something. You get a load of cash and that's yours. NatWest has spent its 2023 dealing with scandals, though, and getting itself into a mess. And I'm kind of worried that they've basically sat out this cyclical uplift, or at least not done as well as they ought to have in this cyclical uplift. And if you're a cyclical business, then you do have to do well in the kind of upcycle bit. Investors arguably ought to put up with you in a down cycle. When interest rates become less favourable, then you struggle a bit more. And it's probably quite short-sighted as an investor to say, well, this is dreadful, profits have gone down, just because it's not a helpful environment anymore. But equally, you need to work out the environment where you are good, and you need to be positioned to do well. And I'm a bit concerned, my big concern with NatWest, is that they have spent a significant amount of their time running into fires and legislation and issues around corporate governance that got in the way of their ability to make the most of what really ought to have been quite a strong tailwind behind them. You can sort of see them underperforming some of the other banks at the moment, which makes me less interested in this public offering thing. I was trying to work out why I would be interested in it, and I'm pretty sure I'm not interested in it at full value, or whatever full value is. But at a deep enough discount, I'm not sure. I just generally can't see my way to buying this at the moment, Steve. It's the one of the banks that I feel least positively about. But you feel any better?
I'm just looking down these results. They're not awful, but I understand your point here that they are the worst of the three. But I mean, there's a return on tangible equity here, Steve, about 17.8% and $3.6 billion in distributions. So they've done okay by shareholders. They've tried their best. But then you look at the 5-year performance of the stock, and it's down essentially 18.5% over the last 5 years. So, and with Farage promising to make life as difficult as possible for Paul Thwaite, you can imagine the Farage cheerleaders will be out to make it as difficult as possible. They will not be banking with NatWest, Steve. Oh my gosh, they won't. Even if the mortgage is the cheapest product out on the market, that they'll go somewhere else and pay more, because that's the kind of tribalism, outsourcing your critical thinking to tribalism, that we do as a populace at the moment. But yeah, I mean, these are okay results. They're not the greatest. I'm sort of looking down them now, thinking the same as you. They've kind of missed a golden opportunity by messing around doing stuff, and Barclays have as well. Let's not cover Barclays in any glory here. Barclays and NatWest have both messed around over the last 10 years, paying fines and having poor governance and all things that, if you just stopped prattling around, you could have took advantage of what has been, you know, for bankers, a period of, you know, where they should have all been golden geese, really. And you look at it and you're thinking, well, it's not really worked out for NatWest. They're trading at about 4x earnings at the moment, Steve, which is not great. And their impairments have crept up. There's an impairment charge of 578 million quid here. It's about 15 basis points of customer loan, so it's not massively high. It is low, but it's still, you know, that's a decent amount of Stage 3 defaults. You know, and one thing that people, you know, should probably keep their eye on. So it's not terrible. My one sort of takeaway from all of these banks is that I'm really glad they're all focusing on buybacks as well as dividends, as capital returns. I'm hoping that carries itself on to, you know, the next cyclical upturn for them if we ever experience another time with decent interest rates, Steve. But I'm glad to see them. I mean, because it makes no sense, really, dividending out, you know, all of your earnings when your stock's trading at 4x earnings and your book's trading at like 0.5% book or 0.7 book. It makes no sense to dividend that out whatsoever. You might as well, if you loaned out to those people in the first place, Steve, you might as well buy those loans back at, you know, less than you sent them out at. So I don't know. NatWest and Barclays, I mean, for some reason, I've started building baskets of stocks, Steve, with like Palo Alto and Fortinet and things like that. And I wonder if perhaps a basket of these three that we've talked about today might actually not be the worst idea in the world.
If you think that there's something good coming for the UK banks, then yeah, I can see my way towards a basket. They look like three very distinctive types of things. I know they're all UK banks, so Lloyds is a kind of pure play UK bank, you might call it that. Barclays is a mix between that with an investment banking arm attached. And NatWest is cheap, basically. It trades at lower multiples than all the other things. And the arguments that I've seen for buying NatWest over Lloyds, and I saw at the start of the year a case being made for long NatWest, short Lloyds, a move that would have worked all right, actually, based on the recent earnings move there, was just that the discount on NatWest is too big. This is kind of, it's not proper Ben Graham-y stuff, but it is a sense of, look, no one's telling you it's a better business. What we're telling you is it's a much cheaper business, and the much cheaper bit offsets the not better bit. And that's a coherent argument. That's an argument you can make, right? We may disagree with that, we might agree with it, or we might just think it's a matter of temperament and think, I don't want to buy a bank that I don't think is the best bank around at the moment, even at any kind of price. It's clearly not an argument that I would make based on my portfolio, so maybe I ought to look a bit more carefully about this. But I can always disagree with the thought, I guess, that the discount is worth it, and that I would want it cheaper than this before I started thinking about buying it. But overall, broadly speaking, familiar themes for the UK banks. It'll be interesting to see where things go next from here. I mean, a lot is tied to the future of interest rates. The next move for the interest rates appears to be down. And I guess we will see how much things kind of contract here. They look extremely cheap at the moment if rates stay higher for longer, which I'm not of a view that says it's crazy to do that. So looping back to your kind of question from the start of this, basket on these? Maybe. I don't think it's a crazy idea by any means.
Fair enough. Steve, do you have time to do Rolls-Royce quickly and then I'll do Nvidia and we'll keep people for an hour and 20?
Sure. If you like, we can talk about Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce, then, another popular FTSE 100 stock. That did pretty well as a result of its earnings this week. The stock is up 9% from there. I said last week in a Motley Fool article that I thought the rally was just getting started in Rolls-Royce shares. That's a big call with the thing up 130%, but it's up another 9%, so I'm well on my way here. Thing is up close to 170% over the last 12 months. This is one where we recorded a little video on this at the start of the year, and I kind of outlined what I thought might be an investment thesis. For full disclosure, I do not own this stock. I do not intend to buy the stock either, but I can see why someone might. Going into the start of the year, here was my sort of thesis, by the way. The market cap was at about 25 billion back then. That will become important in a moment. It's now at 30 billion, and that will also become important in a moment, but bear with me. Air travel then has been recovering post-pandemic, and it's starting to level off. It started to level off towards the start of the year, I think, and probably is reaching more or less its pre-COVID levels now. There's still growth to come for this company, though, I was saying, because its balance sheet has not recovered from the pandemic. It's still got total debt that, okay, it's creeping down, but it's way higher than 2019 levels, and its share count is miles higher than 2019 levels. So there's plenty to be done there in terms of bringing the share count down, reducing the amount you pay out in interest, and therefore driving your earnings and free cash flow higher like that. Even if it's going to be hard, you can get somewhere by increasing prices, and the company has been getting somewhere by increasing prices and top-line growth. But I think the kind of large tailwind from post-pandemic recovery stuff is pretty much out of the way for this. So they had said before that in the medium term, they're looking for around $3 billion in annual free cash flows. And I said, when the thing had a market cap of $25 billion, if you get to $3 billion per year in the medium term and you buy this thing at $25 billion, you're going to be sitting pretty nicely with that, chucking out about 12% of your market cap every year and doing whatever it is they do with it. There's talk of a dividend returning for that again this year. You could buy back a lot of stock with that. You could bring down your debt and drive your free cash flow even higher. I think at the start of the year, I thought there could still be value here if they can hit that target. So the point of this earnings report, then, if you thought what I thought about this, is basically it's a checkpoint on the way to this $3 billion market. So how are we doing? Are things broadly on track for the next bit? Or are we struggling and starting to bump up against the ceiling and the things are going wrong and it's going to be tougher than we thought? You be the judge, if you like, but I'll tell you what I think in a second. The numbers for the year are not a massive secret because they reported during the year. This just plugs in the kind of final bit of it. But revenues are up 22% from where they were to $16.49 billion. The underlying operating profit, which is a metric they report that is effectively, I mean, you could call it an adjusted operating profit. It's an attempt at trying to normalise things, basically. So it strips out some one-off stuff. That's up 130% to $1.59 billion. Ignore the kind of up numbers here. These are all against low-ish comps, and free cash flow came in at $1.3 billion. So we're coming off a low base here, but we are getting back to sort of pre-COVID levels, and in fact pretty much all of those metrics. There are some kind of reasons for thinking that actually it might not just be pandemic recovery anymore. We might be reaching a kind of cyclical reasonable high here. Military spending, which is a part of Rolls-Royce's business, we think of it as consumer aviation, and it's heavily tied to consumer aviation, but military spending at the moment, in case anyone hadn't noticed, is quite high right now, and there's a real question as to how far you think that will be sustainable. Travel demand, equally strictly, the UK is in a recession, in case anyone hadn't noticed, or it was at the end of last year anyway. There's a chance travel demand might drop off a little bit. So I think there are some kind of cyclical tailwinds that are helping here, but broadly speaking, I think things are moving in the right direction here. I looked at reports from two investment banks that had kind of contrasting views on this. One of them was bewildering to me, and the other one I agree with. So UBS thought this was slightly disappointing because some investors might have been expecting $2 billion in free cash flows, and they got $1.3 billion. Okay, fair enough. JP Morgan thought this was great because they thought that, guidance is what they were looking at there. They're guiding for between 1.7 and 1.9 in free cash flow next year on a market cap of now $30 billion. UBS thought that looked perhaps a little bit weak. Some people have been hoping for $2 billion, so 1.7 to 1.9 is maybe light. I mean, it's higher than the kind of midpoint in the consensus on this, so there's plenty of investors that are not disappointed, but maybe some are. JP Morgan thought it was amazing, and they've hiked their price target from £4 to £4.75 per share, which is higher than I'd be willing to go at these levels. But nonetheless, I am broadly on the side of JP Morgan here that says this is a sign that stuff is moving in the right direction. If you think the kind of end goal for the midterm is $3 billion in annual free cash flows, okay, we're moving towards that. We're moving towards that at what I think is a decent rate. We're going to go from 1.3 to 1. Let's say 7 or so next year. And we continue to work towards 3 in various ways. And I think, broadly speaking, the 9% jump is about right. I thought this looked very cheap at the start of the year at $25 billion for something that was going to produce $3 billion. As we get a little bit closer to making that more plausible, the share price gets a little bit closer to what it ought to be if we're going to make that plausible. It's trading at a discount to other things in its sector if you believe those free cash flow projections. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, but certainly they are projections and there is therefore uncertainty. It's reaching the point now, though, where I start to think that we're getting priced to reach that $3 billion, not this is a steaming bargain if we reach that $3 billion. So it's reached a point where I probably think that ship has sailed for me, but I would wish Rolls-Royce shareholders luck, and congratulations especially to the ones who owned it from a year or more ago, effectively, unless they owned it in 2019, in which case, more of the good luck thing. But yeah, Steve?
So just really looking through this report, there's two bits in here that I really like. So back in COVID, when we said this was a don't touch, mainly because they'd had to basically ruin their own balance sheets to stay alive. There was a couple of things that we were really worried about, was that the massive amounts of dilution and the massive amounts of debt taken on. But what I'm looking at here is a company that is really committed to addressing that debt now, which is great when you've got a company generating the sort of record cash they have. Sometimes they can rush to buybacks or rush to dividends and try and try and attract the sort of investors that they want for long term. But one of the ways to get long term investors, Steve, is to improve your balance sheet. So just looking at this now, net debt has improved from 3.3 billion to 2 billion. So they've got 4.1 billion of drawn debt, which 0.5 billion matures this year, 0.8 billion next year, 2.8 billion in between 2026 and 2028. They've got about 1.7 billion in lease liabilities, which means that they've got 3.7 billion in cash and cash equivalents, 3.5 billion in undrawn facilities. That's about 7.2 billion of total liquidity. So they're going to pay the 2024 and 2025 bonds from cash, Steve. Which is interesting. I think that's a very good move. They've also cancelled a 1 billion undrawn UK export finance loan, which they took last year. And they've also cancelled a 1 billion undrawn bank loan facility, reflecting a higher cash balance, meaning they're in a more resilient position. They don't need that. And then this little tip at the end of the report. We're not making shareholder payments for 2023. As we shared at our Capital Markets Day in November 2023, once we are comfortably within an investment grade profile and the strength of our balance sheet is assured, we are committed to reinstating and growing shareholder distributions. That is key. And that is, you know, the difference between the company during COVID and the company today. That two little paragraphs there, Steve, tells you all you need to know about this management. They have got their heads screwed on, and I think this is a very fine report again.
Yeah, it is a very fine report. The risks here don't look to me like that debt is going to run out of control or anything like that. They look like they're working hard to do it. The risks look like to me more like execution or operation risks, in terms of, look, even back pre-pandemic for the moment, before we got into all this balance sheet stuff, they were having durability issues with blades on their Trent 1000 engines. And I think there is general talk from their customers that durability is still a going issue with the engineering there. There are limited choices for switching, but GE is an option for aviation engines. And they've been working hard, Rolls-Royce, on hiking prices since Tufan Erginbilgic. See, I've had to learn how to say that name because they're a significant concern of ours. Since he got in charge, and some of their customers are just starting to complain that maybe you could sort out the products first and then hike the prices afterwards, hey, rather than just charging us more for the same old stuff. So the risk to my mind with these looks more like, can they keep pushing prices through the way they want to, or can they build a better product, basically is my kind of question there. But in general, I thought this report looked pretty strong. If this is supposed to be a report around the financials, then the financials are looking, I think, increasingly better. It looks like a company heading in the right direction. I'm sort of reasonably positive here. This updates our view from the start of the year, so about 6 weeks ago, maybe. Steve, something like that, the last time we had one of these. We'll see you at the next Rolls-Royce earnings for whatever our view on it is then, I guess.
Sounds good. I will quickly run through NVIDIA then, and then we'll let everybody go, seeing as though we've already taken a lot of everyone's time. Market was in sort of trepidation mode going up to this. Not a lot of stocks did well, Steve, in the week up to NVIDIA earnings. There was a lot of jokes about NVIDIA being Atlas holding up the US economy. And that's pretty much what they reported, to be honest with you. So on the quarter, Steve, revenue was $22.1 billion. That's only up 265%. Gross profit came in at 16.8 billion. That's a margin of 76%. That's only up 338%. Net income was 12.3 billion. That's a margin of 56%. That's only up 769%. Generated 11.5 billion in operating cash flow. It's a margin of 52%, up 411%, and only 11.2 billion in free cash flow, 546% up, a margin of 51%. So just to quickly give you the full years as well. So remember, there was one quarter of not so good in this earnings, so, and three quarters of very good. So realistically, you could add another 20 billion to this for next year to get somewhere near like the kind of figures that they've generated. But full year 24 was revenue 60.9 billion. That was only up 126%. Gross profit of 44.3 billion, only up 188%, margin of 73%. Net income came in at 29.8 billion, up 581%, a margin of 49%. 28.1 million in op cash flow, up 400%, margin of 46%. And free cash flow, 26.9 billion, only up 619%, a margin of 44%. In terms of segment, Steve, as you can guess, data center revenue was 18.4 billion on the quarter. That's up 409%. Gaming, 2.9 billion plus 28%. Professional visualization was 463 million plus 105%. Auto slipped a little bit, 281 million down 4%. And OEM and other was 90 million plus 7%. They gave some pretty strong guidance as well, Steve. They said revenue would be about 24 billion. Gross profit margin would be about 76.3%. And they said that OPEX would be about 3.5 billion. So that's going to be another very, very strong report. I'm going to put a link in the description for anybody who wants a good summary of the call from Eugene Ng at Vision Capital. He's gone through it with a lot of detail. But I've just got two things in here, Steve, that I thought was pretty interesting that I'll read out. And here's an interesting one. So Auto contributed over $1 billion of data center revenue in this quarter. So they said that they estimate that data center revenue contribution of the automotive vertical through the cloud or on-prem exceeded $1 billion last year. NVIDIA Drive infrastructure solutions included systems and software for the development of autonomous driving, including data ingestion, curation, labeling, and AI training. And they now said that over 80 vehicle manufacturers are using NVIDIA's AI infrastructure. They actually expect NVIDIA's automotive data center processing demand to grow quite significantly. So they said, and I quote, almost 80 vehicle manufacturers across global OEMs, new energy vehicles, trucking, robotaxis, and tier one suppliers are using NVIDIA's AI infrastructure to train large language models and other AI models for automated driving and AI cockpit applications. In effect, nearly every automotive company working on AI is actually working with NVIDIA. As AV algorithms move to video transformers and more cars are equipped with cameras, we expect NVIDIA's automotive data center processing demand to grow quite significantly. Steve, they really came through here with this report. This is, well, probably stronger than we expected.
Again, yep. The kind of ongoing game with these, and I was listening to the Barons the other week. Now, this isn't a consumption segment, but it's nonetheless true, is that it seems to be like a game of constantly pushing the thing higher, with in the analysts push higher with their estimates and NVIDIA goes past them, and analysts push higher with their estimates and NVIDIA goes past them. And there is some truth to, yes, sooner or later that game will stop, but if it's later rather than sooner, there's a lot to be kind of had from this. And look, I would have been in the camp that said that's going to happen a lot sooner than it has. So it's one thing to think that NVIDIA forward price earnings ratio isn't too bad. It's one of these, the takeaway from this is the same thing as it's been for the last recent set of impressive things, which is, okay, trailing numbers look ugly, forward numbers look a bit high, but if you thought that two lots of trailing numbers ago, or two lots of forward numbers ago, you'd be thinking forward numbers now look pretty attractive here. It's a real tough one to try and estimate the size of this market, isn't it? I mean, it's the kind of thing that feels to me like companies don't dare not be in, or certain kinds of companies don't dare not be in. Plenty of them don't. And it's slightly strange to me. So compare this with the drop in cybersecurity stuff from earlier this week, where customer spending was just slowing down a little bit for places like Palo Alto and across the board in the sector, CrowdStrike, another example. I was surprised by this, and I think I said to you, and that I'm just surprised that anyone dares not spend, cut their spending on cybersecurity, to be honest. It looks like that really ought to be kind of almost a non-negotiable. Maybe there are negotiables about where you send your cybersecurity thing, and switching costs are reasonably high, but for the right price reduction, you could be incentivized to switch, sure. I was surprised to learn that that wasn't true, which is good reason I'm not in that space. But something similar feels true here, of companies don't dare not be in this kind of space, and they don't dare not be buying from Nvidia here, because as fast as Nvidia can produce these things, they're flying out the door again. There was some talk about lead times that I heard about in the run-up to this, but gosh, this is an impressive report. And just to an extent, this is largely deja vu, because Nvidia was a big and genuinely very big company based on its last set of earnings, and its earnings blazed past those. There isn't much to add from my perspective of, okay, now it's a bigger thing and it's blazed past that as well. What becomes the case at the market cap now that wasn't the case at the market cap at the last earnings call? Well, we're closer to whatever the law of large numbers says about bumping up against the ceiling here. But we were close to it before, or at least we looked close to it before. It's the kind of stock where you start wondering, well, exactly when do large numbers start to count then? Because they don't appear to be working so far, and things just seem to be keep going through. And this is a very impressive report from what I can see of it, just in terms of basic production numbers and sales.
Yeah, and the annoying part is, Steve, I was just looking through our WhatsApp chats, and I haven't been able to find it in time, but I'm fairly certain around about 130, I said to you, where does Nvidia get interesting to you? And you said that you'd not looked, and I said, I think about 120 is where I would get in. And I remember it getting down to about 125 and thinking, I'll be patient and I'll just wait for that extra $4 or $5 to come down, and it never did, and it's now at $788.17. So I think sometimes, Steve, I say to you, I get a bit sick of waiting, and if I think it's got more than a 10% annual return, that $5 price shouldn't matter. And I'm not sure why it mattered to me then. On the flip side, it's not something I could buy today, Steve. It's something I'm really happy to watch, and I'm obviously really happy for anybody who's been in this, who's done very well out of it as well. But in the same vein, that I can't bet against it. I see people sat there saying that it's a bubble, and it can't be a bubble, Steve, because it's only trading about 38 times earnings, and it's growing at a 200 and something percent. That's not a bubble. That is, it might be some short-term investment in data center and AI that might not continue, but that's not a bubble. It's not just going up for no reason. This isn't like, you know, looking at the dot-com bubble and saying like, well, all of these companies are vaporware. None of them actually sell anything, or none of them have got any chance of making any money. Nvidia makes real, real money at really high rates and is growing at a ridiculous pace and is forecasting to continue growing beyond that point as well. So I can't buy it. I think it's too high. I think it's ran off too much. I think I'm psychologically incapable of buying it. But I could make a case for buying it, Steve. If you wanted me to sit down and write an article about buying Nvidia, I could do that for you. But whether I could actually buy it with my own money, don't think so.
It's one of the things that gives me mixed feelings about being an index investor. I'm not one, but I mean, I'm sort of torn between two thoughts here, right? So one thought is that if you were an index investor and you were rebalancing in, let's say, the end of March, and let's assume that no share prices move between now and then, you're going to buy Nvidia at this because you need to maintain your weighting of your portfolio in Nvidia. It's now bigger than it was before. Other things are smaller, and you will have to buy it at today's prices to maintain your weighting. Now, that doesn't feel great to me, to be honest. And you'll have to sell something that's fallen down, and maybe that you sell something that don't think that want to get rid of here. But that was true a quarter ago as well. I would have been saying, well, Nvidia's just got bigger. You now have to buy it at these levels. And if you'd bought it, you'd have done very nicely, thanks, in these cases. So there's a real swings and roundabouts here to the index thing, right? You would have bought Nvidia a long time ago when I didn't. You'd have been buying it ever since when I haven't. You would have participated in a lot of that upside, not all of it, because you'd have been adding as you went along, but you'd have got significant amount of upside return there. The cost of that is you would now be committed to buying it today. Is that worth it? Probably yes, for the index guys, to be honest. I mean, I say that I'm very closely adjacent to the S&P 500, so arguably it's a coin flip either way. But by avoiding Nvidia, I'm not obviously doing better than outperforming it. I had a prediction for a spread thing; it was had Nvidia on the short side, so I'm definitely getting whooped there. But I'm fascinated to see how far this one will go. But I am armchair fascinated. I think I would struggle to write out the bull case for it from here as clearly as you would, Steve. But that doesn't mean it's not there. And as I've been saying before now, I would have struggled to write the bull case at a much lower price as well. And I would clearly have to have been, that would just have to have been a failure of my understanding and imagination. So not much to take away from it besides those things.
Yeah, agree with that completely, Steve. Yeah, I think it is. It was a failure of my imagination as well. I was looking at the gaming segment of Nvidia at that point around 125 and thinking if we can just get back to sort of 10 or 12% growth per annum in that kind of area, we'll be cooking on gas. And then they hit me with a 250% growth in an area that I wasn't expecting. So fair play to anybody who did see that. Congratulations on that large dividend you collect every quarter as well.
Yeah, as a sort of final thought on that, I mean, do you think Nvidia saw that? I mean, when do you think Nvidia saw that? I mean, they kind of bet the farm on gaming at one point, and the idea that everyone was going to be a gamer and GPUs are important to gaming and they matter. And then they were GPUs were really important to kind of crypto mining, which worked until it didn't, basically. And then they've sort of found their way into AI as well. They're in the right place at the right time. And whether or not they kind of foresaw an AI surge or when they foresaw an AI surge doesn't matter in the slightest. Their cash is their cash. Their moat is their moat. Their business is their business. Their competitive position is their competitive position. Whether they fell into it by accident or steered into it by design or some combination of the two, who cares? We are where we are. But I'm sort of fascinated as to how far it's a case of finding yourself in the right place at the right time versus putting yourself in the right place at the right time.
Now, I think there's definitely a case of, if they did it once, it was lucky, but they have managed to get ahead of where the demand is and have a product ready and raring to go a number of times now. So I think that's credit where credit's due. And they obviously knew that data center was going to be a big thing. I can't imagine they would have told you that they would have started randomly growing at 256% in the middle of 2023 or whenever it was. I can't imagine they would have told you that. But they have a very strong architecture moat with CUDA, which is CUDA. So that is their software application, which allows you to basically tweak how the Nvidia graphics chips actually perform. But they also have things like InfiniBand, Mellanox, and Spectrum X now, which is a new thing that they're doing with Ethernet. All of these things are sort of strong architecture style moats for their chips. So they have definitely seen this coming. They've had these products for a long time now. I think Mellanox they bought maybe a couple of years ago, but the CUDA, the software, has been around for a bit and has been something that they've tweaked for quite a long time. So I have got to give them credit here rather than say it is luck. I think they are quite often ahead of the curve.
I think I agree. There's a conversation for another day about different semiconductor companies and exactly what's been going right and wrong with those and how far it's a difficult industry versus how far it's management skill or otherwise. And I think there's more to be had on that, maybe for next week. But happy to leave it there, Steve, for this one.
Yeah, that's it.
Great. In that case, thank you all very much for sticking with us while we've talked about various things on this show. Join us next week. We'll be talking about plenty more. But for now, bye from us.